he wrote on Reddit. If you are in a crew, keep your OPSEC up 24/7. Friends will try to take you down if they have to. This echoed a lesson which Manning had learned firsthand a year earlier. But the mutual problem of snitches is the most tenuous of the emergent connections between WikiLeaks and Anonymous. We can trace a more direct coupling by looking at the trajectory of a non-ops. DDoSing on Random Dice Day. Anon-ops emerged in 2010, just a few months after Hope ended. It began as a new Anonymous node and eventually grew into a full-blown IRC network. The network would take the world by storm thanks to its experiments, and I do mean quite literally experiments, as the group never carefully thought through anything until much later, with a slew of direct-action political tactics. Many of these were straight-up illegal, so it was only a matter of time before they drew the attention of the FBI. Although the history of Anon-Ops would come to intersect with WikiLeaks in December 2010, these two entities could not be more different when judged from the perspective of organizational mechanics. WikiLeaks was built up as a carefully sculpted life's work. Assange, as founder and spokesperson, controlled, too tightly, many would come to say, most aspects, and his personality and identity became hopelessly intertwined with the WikiLeaks name. When his personal reputation was sullied, it tarnished the organization as a whole. On the other hand, the constitution of Anon-Ops was a happenstance affair, like Project Chanology before it. Born in the contingent convergence of timing and media attention, each element contributed to its meteoric rise and rapid success. A reminder again of how tricksters, like Anonymous, are perfectly poised to exploit the accidents gifted to them and sometimes benefit from acting on a whim. It was late August 2010, about 2.5 years after hackers had first adopted the name Anonymous to venture into activism. By this time, Chanology had organized street protests, forged tight alliances and friendships with ex-Scientologists, dabbled in Iran's unsuccessful Green Revolution, and branched out into other areas of internet activism. In February 2010, after Australia's telecommunication minister proposed regulation to filter internet pornography, some Anons rolled out Operation Titstorm and successfully overwhelmed government servers with a barrage of traffic requests. This op, proclaimed as part of the Operation Freedom movement, was a harbinger of what was soon to come. A number of Anons relaunched the Operation Freedom movement, rebranded the Internet Freedom Movement, IFM, on July 5th, 11 days before Hope. Those involved in the IFM, along with the geek world at large, had set their sights on protesting the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA. ACTA sought, among other things, to introduce sweeping regulations which would criminalize copyright infringement and encourage internet service providers to profile, track, and monitor their users. Opposition was fierce, and nearly every group involved in the politics of access, Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Free Software Foundation, Public Knowledge, La Quadrature du Net, criticized the secrecy under which the treaty was being negotiated and categorically opposed its ratification. The proposed methodology of the IFM was to lobby politicians and raise public awareness using propaganda materials and websites. As part of these efforts, advocates created a dedicated chat room called Pound Anti-ACTA Planning on the IRC server Occultus Terra. In late August 2010, an Anon activist going by the nickname Gollum, not his usual pseudonym, entered the chat room and boldly declared his intent to move things forward by DDoSing the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, USTR, website, ustr.gov, at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on September 19, 2010. The USTR's office was a natural choice, given that ACTA was a U.S.-led trade agreement and the USTR had the muscle to levy sanctions against nations that violated trade treaties. But many people in the chat room had concerns. First, Chanology had already set a political precedent by disavowing the use of illegal tactics like DDoS. And second, no one could understand why that particular date had been chosen. It struck many as completely arbitrary, and it mostly was. The one connection was that September 19th is Talk Like a Pirate Day. Gollum faced vehement opposition, at least from those who were paying attention to their screens. All pseudonyms have been changed. Maddie, why before it is signed? Gollum, because it's a Sunday and everyone likes Sundays. Maddie, again, why before it is signed? Gollum, and because I threw a dice, and it said 19th. My prediction is by September 19th, people will become more aware. Trust me on this, September 19th. Fat Albert, trust me on a random dice day. Although everyone on the channel savaged Gollum's proposal, he remained unmoved. Gollum, whatever, listen, I've heard all the arguments for not DDoSing, but the truth is we need to wake them up. I understand that DDoSing could potentially harm our cause, but I think the risk is worth it. Fat Albert, well, I, as for myself, disagree, therefore I'm not helping with DDoS. Gollum, we need attention. Void, oh my god, it's the Anonymous. The only thing they do is DDoS. Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. Let's make ACTA pass on positive. Gollum, no. Maddie, how did contacting the politicians go? Bam Bam, yeah, I've always kind of hated DDoS. Gollum, look, I've heard the arguments. I just wanted to say we should do this. We are not DDoSing now. This will be in 20 days. 20 days is a lot of time. A few Anons, conveying the legal risks, highlighted the difference between targeting the U.S. government and targeting other entities, and then considered the conversation over. Note also that the risk assessment about arrests was accurate. Over 27 individuals have been since indicted for the ensuing spate of DDoS actions. And in the United States, you can still get in deep trouble for targeting anyone famous. Maddie, this is not Justin Bieber. This is the U.S. government, for fuck's sake. Gollum, everyone please, listen to me when I speak. Anon Law, I'll be laughing as you go to jail. Maddie, I am not here for the fucking lols. Gollum, it's official. Start preparing. If you are wondering about just what official means in Anonymous, well, yes, something can be deemed official if someone declares it as such, and, crucially, if enough people also support it. But at the time, support for militant direct action tactics on this IRC channel were lacking. Although someone had initiated an IRC channel called Pound DDoS with the mandate of discussing the possible use of the tactic, the freewheeling aspect of anonymous IRC chat only goes so far before bumping up against norms and rules. Lola, what happened to Pound DDoS? Fred, take that too off topic, please. This is strictly for ACTA planning, not for a chit chat. Lola, Pound DDoS was an ACTA planning channel. I want to know what happened to it. Fred, questions about Pound DDoS is off topic. This is for planning. Jägermeister, Pound DDoS is bad. The next day, Lola appeared again, this time to discuss botnets, networks of remotely controlled computers which can be used to strengthen a DDoS assault. Lola, do you have a botnet? Without one, you can't do much. You can get like $10 for 100 these days. From some skiddy forums. Lola is told again to stop discussing illegal activities. This is, perhaps, an opportune moment to discuss botnets in more detail, especially since they became increasingly important to the anonymous DDoS operations we will consider a little later. There is a Wild West cattle rustling aspect to the whole affair. A botnet is essentially just a collection of computers connected to the internet, allowing a single entity extra processing power or network connections toward the performance of various tasks, including, but not limited to, DDoSing and spam bombing. A botnet is a very powerful tool, involving, as it does, computers that are connected across various parts of the world and capable of distributing tasks. Participants whose computers are tapped for membership in a botnet usually have no idea that their computer is being used for these purposes. Have you ever wondered why your computer worked so slowly or strangely? Well, you might have unwittingly participated in a DDoS. A computer most often becomes a member of a botnet by getting infected with malware. This can happen through a number of different methods. That hilarious cat video you downloaded, the malicious link in an email from your aunt, a phishing attack you didn't even know about, or a virus piggybacking on some software you downloaded from the internet. Once infected, the computer runs a small program, usually hidden in the process table so it is not easily found, which mediates its involvement in the botnet. Although there are many different ways for a botnet to work, one classic method involves connecting it to a pre-configured IRC server and channel. Once this connection is made, the computer will wait patiently, unbeknownst to their owners, awaiting orders from the botnet herder. Yeehaw! The herder is the individual capable of directing the computers that make up the botnet. Typically, this is the person who infected the computers in the first place. Usually, he or she is waiting in the designated IRC channel, grinning from ear to ear as more and more infected computers join the channel, like zombies awaiting orders. This is known as the Command and Control Channel, CNC. A typical scenario might see a herder tabbing back and forth between regular chat channels and the hidden CNC channel, as it grows more powerful by the moment. A typical botnet might boast around 20,000 computers, but larger botnets have been tracked to upwards of 30 million. Though most botnets have a bad rap, and for good reason, some botnets are voluntary and participatory. The most famous of these is probably SETI at Home, the 3 million strong string of computers searching for alien life in outer space. They hover on this CNC channel until the botnet herder gives them an order, usually authenticated, to perform some task. So, for example, the botnet herder might simply say, DDoS 172.16.44.1, and then all the connected bots will begin to attack that specified IP address. Another common task for botnets is to send mass amounts of unwanted email. Spam is often stopped by an algorithm which determines its unwanted nature and blocks the sending addresses. But when tens of thousands of different machines with different addresses are sending the spam, it is much harder to track down and stop. Often, botnet herders assemble their network not for their own purposes, but in order to sell the services of their bots to a spammer. To be able to control tens of thousands of computers from a central location is a powerful feeling. By simply issuing commands, you can make thousands of computers do something for you, and the larger the number of computers participating, the more powerful those commands are. In the botnet world, there is an ongoing struggle over who has the most bots, the most bandwidth, and the best infected machines. University, corporate, and government computers tend to be on better bandwidth. This competition is so fierce that botnet herders will often try to take over other botnets. On the other side of the fence, law enforcement agencies and individual organizations that are fighting spam also struggle to take over botnets in order to neutralize them. This is not a trivial thing to do. One has to first identify the CNC. If you can figure out where the bots get their commands from, you can join the IRC channel, masquerading as a compromised machine, and wait to receive a command from the botnet herder. If the botnet herder sends an authentication alongside the command, you may have the password necessary to issue commands to the entire botnet yourself. But, as Lola indicated, you can also access all that fun and power for a cheap subscription fee. People on the IRC server were not happy with all this talk of the underworld of botnets and DDoSing. The IRC operators booted the pro-DDoS contingent from the server. They left undeterred, becoming anonymous nomads. It is perhaps ironic that Gollum, as one participant explained it to me, was a central figure in the IFM movement, if not the central figure. Gollum may have spearheaded the initiative, but his influence waned as he clamored for the types of digital tactics firmly rejected by the majority of Anons driving Chanology. Effectively, this majority managed to change the direction of the operation so as to keep it entirely legal. Those wanting to use direct action techniques found themselves increasingly marginalized. But while Gollum's random dice day vision may have seemed to them nothing more than, well, random, Gollum was actually an adept organizer with a keen feel for media dynamics. I had seen him in action many times, and he was one of the finest propagandists and organizers in all of Anonymous. Gollum left the IFM to form a new direct action-oriented wing, taking some Anons with him. One participant in the new militant enterprise, which would come to be known as Anon-Ops, described Gollum as having a very, very good antenna for PR and propaganda, and he realized the, at the time, immense psychological impact of declaring that a website would vanish and then taking it down. Gollum took his tactics and his supporters elsewhere. Strangely, given his announcement of Random Dice Day, he had in fact erected a website with an ACT-UP protest timeline that differed from the one he had announced on the IRC channel. The site designated the crescendo of activities for November 5th, the worldwide day of protests known as Guy Fawkes Day. Gollum had conceived of different groups divided by chat rooms, pound bump, pound new or, pound op, each with distinct roles and responsibilities. Confusion loomed large over the DDoS campaign's start date, but in the end, thanks to the initiative of some unknown actors, it was, as Gollum predicted, to fall in the middle of September. A stunning and spectacular avalanche of DDoS attacks attracted over 700 individuals into the Splinter Group's chat room and continued for over 2 months. In the end, they did not target the office of the U.S. Trade Representative. Instead, in a defense of file sharing, they DDoSed the heck out of a number of pro-copyright associations, such as the Motion Picture Association of America, MPAA, and the Recording Industry Association of America, RIAA. The media attention was significant, and the new crew was hooked. Displaying the Pirate Bay's ship logo, as adopted by Anons as their campaign symbol, the BBC reported, "Piracy activists have carried out coordinated attacks on websites owned by the music and film industry." Anonymous listed every news story written about Operation Payback, as the group called it, on tieve.tk, which also became the go-to hub for information as Anonymous migrated from IRC server to IRC server before establishing one of its own in late October. "Drawing upon my experiences with Anonymous, I can confidently declare that had Gollum's breakaway group simply rallied troops around a slogan like, 'ACTA sucks,' the unprecedented waves of support would never have materialized." Fortunately, the Spirit of Puck delivered a delightful accident to this nascent Anonymous crew. It was as if the trickster of Crossroads, Ishu, then appeared, urging them to make a decision. And, as we will see, their choice allowed the pod to sprout into one of the internet's biggest political sensations. At times, we have to go an extra mile and attack the site. The game-changing piece of information first appeared in a technical news article published by an Indian media outlet on September 5th, 2010. It took a full week for Western journalists to pick up the story, at which point it circulated along the boutique technical press. The story quotes the managing director of Aplex, an Indian software firm purportedly hired by corporations to DDoS file-sharing sites like the Pirate Bay. The problem is with torrent sites, which usually do not oblige when served with a written legal request to take down a movie. In such cases, we flood the website with lots of requests, which results in database error, causing denial of service as each server has a fixed bandwidth capacity. At times, we have to go an extra mile and attack the site and destroy the data to stop the movie from circulating further. Ironically, given the target, that admission essentially provided evidence of a contemporary practice analogous to the privateering of yesteryear. Until outlawed in 1856, European powers routinely hired pirates to operate as their agents on the high seas, with the added advantage of being able to obscure their own involvement in whatever unsavory business they might require the pirates to perform. This was not the first time evidence surfaced that the copyright industries hired technologists to do their illegal dirty work. In 2005, the MPAA employed a hacker to break into the servers of TorrentSpy, a search engine for file-sharing material, and search for confidential information they hoped would provide evidence of law-breaking. During an exclusive interview with Wired.com, this hacker explained how the MPAA attempted to lure him with cash and other luxury goods. "We would need somebody like you. We would give you a nice paying job, a house, a car, anything you needed. If you save Hollywood for us, you can become rich and powerful." But with Aplex, it was the first time the admission was so frank and forthcoming. The reaction from Anonymous and many other geeky quarters of the internet was predictably swift and biting. For well over a decade, the copyright industry slash lobby slash trade associations poured millions of dollars into aggressively hunting down and suing file sharers and hackers who ran peer-to-peer sites, like the Pirate Bay, which coordinate access to troves of copyrighted material. Now segments of the copyright industry were going the extra mile by hiring hackers to engage in illegal tactics of their own to curb illegal file sharing. Geeks criticized Aplex's technical methods. It is common for geeks to take any and all opportunity to debate the merits of any piece of technology. They made fun of Aplex's terrible and asinine criminal confession as PR strategy. And on Torrent Freak, a popular website dedicated to reporting news on file sharing, one commenter noted, "Aplex is just asking." Strike that, I meant begging for trouble. The writer was spot on. Revenge arrived in the form of, did you guess it? A DDoS campaign. Someone took the initiative to take down Aplex, almost certainly using a botnet. Gollum and the other Anons who had set their sights on protesting ACTA through the use of DDoS campaigns exploited this opportunity to shift their energies and attention toward this event. It is perhaps no wonder that Gollum and his followers had no qualms about ditching ACTA, switching targets, and finding a new start date, thanks to another bit of opportunistic chance, just like that initial rolling of the dice. In one of the first propaganda posters for Operation Payback, this new anonymous cell admitted that the DDoS campaign was ahead of schedule, thanks to an unexpected strike made by a single individual. The activists then predicted, "This will be a calm, coordinated display of blood. We will not be merciful." Anonymous boldly signed off, "Good hunting." So was the hunting, as the poster claimed, a calm, coordinated, tactical incision in which Anonymous would show no mercy? Sort of. But, as we will see in a moment, the first few weeks of the campaign were rather chaotic, partially because the influx of supporters was hefty, at least for standards of the time. With so many people, proceeding in a calm and coordinated fashion was difficult. The first campaign launched September 17, 2010, targeting the MPAA's website and taking it offline for roughly 18 hours. Over the next 4 days, Anonymous hit, among other targets, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, Aplex, naturally, the RIAA, and ACS Law, a law firm in the UK that worked on behalf of the copyright industry. From the perspective of these renegade Anons, Operation Payback was a resounding, glorious success, and the media were squeezed for many articles. One of the remarkable feats of Operation Payback was how Anon-Ops managed, using propaganda material alone, to convince both the media and many of their own members that the MPAA had hired Aplex. There is no evidence to support this claim. Instead, it is now widely believed that Aplex had been hired by the Bollywood movie industry. And yet, on September 20th, 2010, scores of reputable news outfits, including Reuters, published statements in the following vein, despite flimsy, non-existent, really, evidence. MPAA.org and the website of Aplex Software, a company the MPAA hired to target sites where piracy was rampant, were incapacitated for much of the day, according to the piracy blog Torrent Freak. Because it was covered extensively in the media, I myself repeated this fib on countless occasions. To this day, I still cannot ascertain who first proposed it, and whether it was born from honest confusion, so many of the core participants truly believed it, or conniving duplicity. Whatever the case, Anonymous would seize upon this newfound specialty in the art of duping the media. After a few days of the operation, Anon-Ops found itself on the verge of its most successful attacks of the season, where it would, in fact, show no mercy. The targeted organization, ACS Law, would be shamed into oblivion thanks to Anonymous's first major leak. I have far more concern over the fact of my train turning up 10 minutes late than them wasting my time with this sort of rubbish. For the ragtag team assembled under the auspices of Operation Payback, the MPAA became the obvious target of preference. But by September 21st, Anonymous could no longer effectively take down the organization's site. The MPAA had implemented sturdy DDoS protection by employing an outside firm. And so, on September 21st, 2010, following vigorous internal debate, Anonymous set its sights on ACS Law, a British law firm notorious for sending threatening letters at the behest of copyright owners to thousands of alleged file sharers, demanding money and the cessation of ostensibly illegal downloading. It took Anonymous much more time to choose ACS Law as its target, 2 hours, than it did to take down the law firm's website, 2 minutes. After the hit, the firm's head solicitor, Andrew Crossley, was so unimpressed by the attack that he hastily volleyed back with the following statement: "It was only down for a few hours. I have far more concern over the fact of my train turning up 10 minutes late or having to queue for a coffee than them wasting my time with this sort of rubbish." But as it turned out, these few hours of website downtime might have cost him his firm. ACS Law's web team was so incompetent that in restoring the site, they accidentally made an entire backup, replete with emails and passwords, available for anyone with a modicum of technical ability to see and take. Anonymous noticed it, snatched it, and promptly threw all the emails on the Pirate Bay. It was the first in a string of stunning, Anonymous-led leaks that provided evidence of grave corporate misconduct. By this time, Crossley's firm was already under government scrutiny. Months earlier, technology journalist Nate Anderson reported on what he described as a spirited debate among members of the House of Lords. As they discussed an amendment called Remedy for Groundless Threats of Copyright Infringement Proceedings, many lords were critical of ACS Law's methods. Lord Lucas, who had proposed the amendment, offered particularly harsh words to ACS Law. "We must also do something about the quantum of damages that is being sought. In a civil procedure on a technical matter, it amounts to blackmail. The cost of defending one of these things is reckoned to be £210,000. The emails obtained by Anonymous simply helped confirm, with a far more granular and damning level of detail, the firm's relentless targeting of alleged copyright violators on behalf of copyright associations. One tactic involved writing married men with allegations that they had downloaded gay porn. Many of these men paid £500 to £600 to make ACS Law go away. The leaked emails were a final decisive blow, and by February 2011, ACS Law had closed down. It bears noting, again, that a non-ops decision to target ACS Law was, like many of its decisions, made in the heat of the chaotic moment. Had the group voted otherwise, the operation would have never transpired. It's worth looking into just how these voting mechanisms work, and the targeting of ACS Law provides a prime example. The public channel #SaveTPB, meaning Save the Pirate Bay, later to become #OperationPayback, hosted, at its peak, over 1,000 participants. Many of them had come from 4chan, where news about Aplex's methods spread and roiled many into action. Those on the public channels were encouraged to use a tool called the Low Orbit Ion Cannon, LOIC for short, subtitled When Harpoons, Airstrikes, and Nukes Fail. LOIC is an open-source application that allows users to individually contribute to a DDoS campaign from the comfort of their home by simply entering the target address and clicking the temptingly giant button marked, "I'm a chargin' my laser." By entering an IP address identified within a channel, users could direct their computers to join a chorus of protesters in sending requests to a target. Alternatively, participants could set LOIC to Hive mode, which allows computers to automatically contribute to the voluntary botnet. Meanwhile, in the private channel first named #SaveTPBMods, and soon after remained #Command, others were engaged in deep, often heated, and utterly confusing debate regarding strategy and targets. Most in the public channel were unaware of the existence of this private channel, unless they were one of the few eventually tapped to join. During an interview, one of the founders of the secret channel explained the selection criteria as follows. "You're invited by another member of #Command if you've proved yourself productive/useful or trustworthy. Presented here are only a tiny number of excerpts from a truly convoluted, yet still semi-coherent, two-hour conversation that occurred in Pound Command as participants decided to target ACS law. Decision-making often follows a liquid path. It opened with the participants noting the impressive number of individuals gathered on the public channel, awaiting, as it were, their orders. Anon 2, 660-plus people. Anon 5, uh-oh, the fan is hitting the shit. Anon 6, yeah. Anon 4, the fan blew up from shit. Anon 7, their MPAA's DDoS protection is working. I suggest we migrate targets. BBI? British Phonographic Industry? Anon 8, why not RIAA, Recording Industry Association of America? Anon 7, because we failed with BPI last time due to small numbers. As they conversed, numbers continued to climb, and they started to worry about momentum and morale. Anon 1. In the meanwhile, there are a number of news articles popping up saying we did at least a lot of damage. Anon 8. What has BPI done? Anon 7. Well... Anon 9. Guys, do not discuss any drama in the main chat. We are here for propaganda, lifting spirits. If we even indicate our efforts are useless, people will leave en masse. It has always been about morale. We don't have, like, 800 people because we tell the truth. We have 800 people that believe they are doing something. Anon 7. Guys, I do not want us to fail in the eyes of the public or make our troops go to waste. We need to migrate targets soon. Disagreement over targets grew, and someone pointed out that the financial hit against MPAA was negligible, since the organization paid a lump sum for its DDoS protection. Eventually, people agreed to stop hammering the MPAA and shift targets. Someone highlighted the nature of this endeavor, but consider it an experiment either way. Prove me wrong. Just when participants thought they reached a consensus, someone yelped and insisted on a vote, as is often the case with any IRC-based meeting, only magnified with a group like Anonymous. Conversation became even more tangled. Anon 7, no, wait, let's vote. Anon 8, we have public opinion now because we do not target random sites. Anon 7, first, let's nominate sites. So far, RIAA and BPI has been nominated. Any others? Anon 9, I think I have the perfect idea. Anon 7, we can vote here. Anon 16, hello? Anon 1, let Anon 9 speak. Anon 9, I think I agree with Anon 13 here. ACS law, full go. Paste their shit website, post the news articles on them, etc. If we divert now, they will have no time to prepare. Anon 1, well, be a new poster with tomorrow's target, same time? Anon 10. I'm in for ACS law too. Anon 4. Me too. Anon 13. Shall we change the topic in the main chat and divert the lasers now, so losing almost nobody, or attack tomorrow, potentially losing hundreds? Anon 8. Someone give me an equally good motivation for a target. Anon 7. Let's vote? Anon 13. I vote for ACS. Anon 7. DDoS ACS law, 1 equals yes, 2 equals no. As some voted, others continued to broadly debate the choice of targets, arguing, attacking anti-piracy agencies at random isn't helping our cause. This prompted another long, tedious round of voting. Finally, 2 hours later, they seemed to have inched closer to an agreement, but in the middle of debating, guess what happened? Anon 7, acs-law.org.uk. Anon 12, give me the info, I said. Anon 7, acs-law.org.uk is down already. Anon 12, the feck? What? Anon 1, oh my god? Anon 13, that was quick. Anon 1, how long did it take us to vote again? Anon 14, longer than it took for it to go down. Someone must have felt that there was enough of a consensus to move forward, and fired up the botnets. 2 hours of planning, 2 minutes of DDoSing, and not long after, the firm closed, A little over a year after Anonymous's email leak, Crossley, who had been more worried about queuing for a coffee, was tried in the solicitor's disciplinary tribunal for an array of charges. He conceded to 6 of the 7 allegations, including the following 2: acting in a way that was likely to diminish the trust the public places in him or in the legal profession, and using his position as a solicitor to take unfair advantage of the recipients of the letters for his own benefit. He was ordered to pay £76,000 in fines and had his license suspended for 2 years. Even though he challenged the claim that he had not taken proper measures to protect client data, he was found guilty as charged, and the Information Commissioner's Office also fined him for the data breach. Although many of Anonymous's actions seek simply to attract media attention for the sake of airing an issue, sometimes fate gave them more than they bargained for, like an incidental opportunity to curb corruption. Weapons of the geek rarely agree. By the end of fall 2010, with a constant deployment of digital direct action techniques, AnonOps had breathed new life into the still nascent idea that Anonymous could be a banner for activism. The name, once exclusively tied to the most abject forms of trolling, was slowly but steadily becoming associated with an irreverent brand of dissent. Regardless, those behind the September and October campaigns, like Gollum and the Numbered Anons, did not expect to exist as a team, much less as a network, for more than a few weeks. But in a mirroring of the events that aggregated Chanology into a discrete entity, media validation helped solidify this new team as well. In a rare interview with Torrent Freak, one core organizer explained why. The operations command was pleasantly surprised by the overwhelming media coverage and attention, but wondered where to go from there. They became the center of attention, but really had no plan going forward. Eventually, they decided to continue down the road that brought them there in the first place: more DDoS attacks. The media attention was indeed part of what fueled the operation to go forward. With AnonOps here to stay, there were also clear signs of a cleavage emerging between different nodes within the activist branches of Anonymous. Chanology and AnonOps, the two most active wings, could not be more different in terms of tactics. One usually stayed within the bounds of the law, and the other avidly and enthusiastically experimented with law-breaking. By way of acknowledging these internal feuds and sectarian impulses, Anonymous would eventually adopt the refrain, "Anonymous is not unanimous." It was around this time that I started to grasp the overarching significance of these disparate and divergent geeks and hackers. Anonymous, Chanology versus AnonOps, Assange, Manning, the Pirate Bay, and others, all entering the political arena, and in much greater numbers than ever before. In orchestrating protests across a range of issues, in particular civil liberties, they transformed policy, law, media representations, and public opinion. While certainly unique in its bombast and capriciousness, Anonymous was clearly part of a wellspring of hackers and geeks who were taking political matters into their own hands and making their voices heard. Anonymous signaled the growing importance of what I call weapons of the geek, in contrast to weapons of the week, a term anthropologist James Scott used in his 1985 book of the same name to capture the uniquely clandestine nature of peasant politics. While Weapons of the Week describes the tactics of economically marginalized populations who engage in small-scale illicit acts, such as foot-dragging and vandalism, that don't appear on their surface to be political, Weapons of the Geek is a modality of politics exercised by a class of privileged and visible actors who often lie at the center of economic life. Technology does not simplistically determine the politics of hacking, even if technological experiences usually inform its expression. Just as there are many ways to hack, there are many ways for hackers to enter the political arena. From policymaking to engagements with pirate parties, from reinventing the law through free software to performing risky acts of civil disobedience, the geek and hacker are not bound to a single political sentiment, such as libertarianism, and they certainly don't agree on how social change should proceed. What they all have in common is that their political tools, and to a lesser degree their political sensibilities, emerge from the concrete experiences of their craft, like administering a server or editing videos. Often these skills are channeled into activities in order to bolster civil liberties, such as piracy. Unlike peasants who seek to remain inconspicuous and anonymous even as a group, geeks and hackers, even the anonymous anonymous, explicitly call attention to themselves via their volatile, usually controversial, political act. By fall 2010, AnonOps was at the forefront of the tests and experiments that sought to probe the new possibilities and legal limitations of digital civil disobedience. And while some would count these experiments as a success, others, even those aligned on the same side of the struggle for civil liberties, were wary of the tactics employed. The Pirate Party in particular was less than enthused about the political use of DDoS. The Pirate Party is a political party which has made inroads in both Europe and Australia and claims a very weak base in North America. Swedish free culture advocate Rickard Falkvinge first chartered it in 2006, and now its platform is built on copyright reform, demands for internet freedoms and civil liberties, and the building of tools to support direct democracy. The pirate parties in the UK and US wrote a letter to AnonOps requesting an immediate cessation of DDoS activity. It should be noted that the letter prompted not only a vigorous debate among AnonOps participants, but among pirate party members themselves. Operation Payback needs to end. While it is certainly an indication that an increasing number of people are becoming frustrated with the way laws are being constantly rewritten to kill our creative culture in the name of preserving profitability, its methods do more harm than good to the global effort. By continuing Operation Payback attacks, you will hamper those who promote copyright reform and curtailment of abuses of copyright, but who do so within the bounds of the law. Instead of being able to argue for legislative reform of copyright on its own merits, they will be accused of defending criminals and promoting lawlessness. It will be easier for legislators and the media to ignore the clear benefits of fair copyrights and free speech in favor of clamoring for harsher legislation to stop those pirates and hackers. Perhaps surprisingly, those Operation Payback participants sitting in Pound Command for a very brief period of time took the Pirate Party's call to heart and considered aborting the use of illegal tactics in favor of a more moderate, reformist style, the advancing of a list of demands. The Torrent Freak interview revealed, publicly, the existence of the secret Pound Command channel and affirmed participants' new embrace of law-abiding tactics. Below are some key excerpts from the interview. The core group is the Pound Command channel on IRC. This core group does nothing more than being some sort of intermediary between the people in that IRC channel and the actual attack. Another group of people on IRC, the main channel called Pound Operation Payback, are just there to fire on targets. Last week, Command decided to slow the DDoS attacks down and choose another strategy, mainly to regain the focus of attention. It was decided that they would make a list of demands for governments worldwide. In a move opposed to the desires of the anarchic influences, Command decided to get involved in the political discussion. This dual news, that there was a secret channel and that its members wanted to go legit, was received extremely poorly by the public-facing channel Pound Operation Payback on AnonOps. The result was, in essence, a mutiny. Gobo, not his real pseudonym, one core participant active on the public channel, who would later become a member of another separate, secretive channel recatalyzed by the revelation, explained, "That article seriously pissed a lot of people in the main channel off. A huge amount of arguing broke out over Anonymous being leaderless and who the fuck do they think they are?" Somehow, Pound Command didn't really perceive how much controversy they were generating by overstepping the limits of their purpose, as defined by the main channel's participant. Little did the Anons crying foul know there was also another, even more secretive channel by the name Pound Internet Feds. Originally chartered for the purposes of executing ops, especially covert hacking, it had gone idle for a period. One of its members reached out to Gobo and invited him to join Pound Internet Feds with a scheme to revive it. The public commitment to a cessation of DDoSing suddenly looked very dubious indeed. Essentially, the ethos was as follows. Operation Payback would publicly stop all illegal activity, as per the letter to the Pirate Party. Pound Internet feds would carry on these activities privately and in the name of Anonymous, but not in the name of Operation Payback, and its existence was to be kept sacredly secret so as not to jeopardize the new, legitimate protest image Pound Command wanted to cultivate for Operation Payback. So a small crew in a small cabal was planning to rekindle another, even smaller and more secretive cabal, committed only loosely to the guiding principle of, like Fight Club, keeping mum about its existence. The group may have operated in secret, but each of its defacements came with a logo that included its name, owned by Pound Internet Feds. As it turned out, Pound Internet Feds never had to carry out this proposed sacredly secret mission, because participants in the main channel essentially told Pound Command to bugger off, affirming their intention to continue to DDoS with or without them. Civil war broke out on the public channel where, according to Gobo, most people roundly condemned not just the idea of going legit, but specifically the fact that Pound Command had so massively leader-fagged by agreeing to all this without even mentioning it to the main channel. There was an extremely bitter argument, and following that, someone simply told people to forget about the Pound Loic Hive and hit the next target manually, with or without the support of Pound Command. Those in Pound Command listened to the angry IRC masses and almost immediately backpedaled on the pledge to make the op go legitimate, explained Gobo. Although Pound Internet Feds was no longer technically needed for this particular DDoS, since Pound Command was put back on the DDoSing track thanks to pressure exerted by those on the public channel, it persisted anyway, ultimately becoming an extremely militant defacement and leaking channel, as Gobo described it, which would really shine in the coming months. Peace had been restored, but barely. Legitimacy versus legality. In September 2010, when a new Anonymous node arose out of the righteous anger born from the double dealing of the copyright industry, it seemed always on the brink of disorder. Action was often heated, messy, soulful, and spontaneous, compounding the thrills experienced by all. Increasingly, Anon-Ops had become more deliberate in its decision-making process, the direct result of collective thinking on the subject of collectivity itself. Undoubtedly, the topic of organization was highlighted by many participants upset at the double standards in operation during the initial campaigns. One of the core hackers explained to me why he felt justified in forging forward with these illegal tactics, a sentiment that seemed to capture the collective mood of the time. I saw it as a form of poetic justice in response to Aplex DDoSing the Pirate Bay. Gobo, who had worked closely with Gollum, highlighted how he always spoke very passionately about the fact that people he'd known from Anonymous had been arrested for taking part in trolling-based DDoS attacks, and yet here were major corporate people boasting about it, and everyone knew 100% that no one would ever prosecute them. Gollum has a very strong ideological belief in the idea that there should be no double standards in politics, and so for him it was the corporations getting away with crimes ordinary people don't get away with. By November, individual sentiments such as these were transformed into a collective political statement. Soon after Anon-Ops retracted its commitment to going legit, the group published a letter to the Pirate Party. It included a sophisticated justification for DDoS that focused on legitimacy over legality. Here is an excerpt. Anonymous and Operation Payback share values and goals. For example, freedom of information, expression, and sharing with the pirate parties, but we are absolutely independent entities. We are not concerned with legality, but with legitimacy. Those who decide our laws are the same people who decided that public copyright harassment, erosion of civil liberties, and abominations of censorship, such as COICA, ACTA, and the DE Act, are good and just things to enforce upon the populace. They do this whilst selectively enforcing their own laws when it comes to official organizations that take actions such as running a mass racketeering operation, knowingly suing thousands of individuals for infringement on bad evidence, or DDoSing sites that are contrary to their interests, Aplex. We do not recognize their authority due to this rank hypocrisy. Finally, we recognize and respect the work of pirate parties and wish them luck. We hope that you all continue your fight, as we are continuing ours. As this letter signals, Anon Ops became reflexive and unabashedly comfortable about stylizing its activities as civil disobedience. Soon after reaching an ethical consensus on DDoSing in November, the numbers on their IRC server dwindled precipitously. Only a smattering of secret cabals remained, tied up in their separate clandestine channels. It was impossible to forecast that, just 3 weeks later, they would launch the largest DDoS civil disobedience campaign the world had ever witnessed. Chapter 4. The Shot Heard Round the World. I've only just a minute, only 60 seconds in it, forced upon me, can't refuse it, didn't seek it, didn't choose it, but it's up to me to use it, I must suffer if I lose it, give an account if I abuse it. Just a tiny little minute, but eternity is in it. Benjamin Elijah Mays, American educator and president of Morehouse College. Commentators often cast Anonymous as an amorphous and formless entity existing in some mythical and primordial, jelly-like state of non-being, only solidifying into existence when an outside agent utters its name. Buying into this logic, some writers suggest that Anonymous and its interventions suffer from an inherent lack of cohesion. The group's hazy message, with no spokesmen, leaders, or firm political plans to provide steady direction, Art Keller wrote for Newsweek, isn't helped by an ideology that veers between extreme left, extreme right, and mainstream concerns. A more prosaic example comes from an Anon himself who relayed the following to me during a personal chat conversation. I spoke to a real-life friend today about Anonymous, and he seemed to have some vision of disembodied brains held in suspension, orbiting the Earth in battle satellites or something. The idea that actual people were involved seemed to flummox him. These generalizations, promulgated by the media and commoners alike, are not only mostly wrong, but they also lead us further away from actually understanding Anonymous. Far from lacking structure or flailing wildly about like a compass at the North Pole, Anonymous incorporates an abundance of relationships, structures, and moral positions. Human beings, speaking, coding, debating, arguing, making art, and acting, are there every step of the way. This sentiment found a particularly nice expression during a conversation I had with Mustafa Al-Bassam, a notable former member of LulzSec, a hacker group that broke away from Anonymous. Exasperated by attempts to catalog every secret channel and collate every relevant note, I found him online one day and pestered him, begged him, really, to provide a neat, tidy, and definitive list of all the channels he could remember. He kindly acquiesced, and in the middle of his meticulous explanation, which still left me confused, he asked, "Do you know kitten core?" Oh, damn. Kitten porn? I thought to myself. Thankfully, he reined in my imagination and clarified, the IRC channel. We had a channel called Pound Kitten Core and another called Pound Upper Deck. The only difference is that Pound Upper Deck had all the same people in Pound Kitten Core, but one less. I asked why they kept one person in the dark. He replied, because he came very late into it, and we became reluctant to have him in the center, and also because he came just as we were splitting the bitcoins. Micro-micro-politics and cabals nested within cabals, I replied. It is precisely this mixture of concreteness and abundance, one channel exactly the same as the other minus one person since he is too new and not yet trustworthy, which makes Anonymous both so difficult to describe and so resistant to being slotted into a prefabricated mental template. Within Anonymous, the pressure and desire to efface the public presentation of self allows the participants to perform an admixture of their souls, conjuring into existence something always emergent and in flux. The number of relationships, fiefdoms, and cliques in simultaneous existence is largely invisible to the public, which tends to see Anonymous from the vantage point of carefully sculpted propaganda and the media's rather predictable gaze. And yet, peering through the computer, we find Anonymous in any instant to be an aggregate sack of flesh, meshed together by wires, transistors, and Wi-Fi signals, replete with miles of tubes pumping blood, pounds of viscera filled with vital fluids, an array of live signaling wires propped up by a skeletal structure with muscular pistons fastened to it, and ruled from a cavernous dome holding a restless control center. The analog of these fabulously grotesque and chaotically precise systems that, if picked apart, become what we call people. Anonymous is no different from us. It simply consists of humans sitting at their glowing screens and typing, as humans are wont to do at this precise moment in the long arc of the human condition. Each body taken alone provides the vector for an irreducibly unique and complex individual history, mirroring in its isolation the complexity of all social phenomena as a whole, which can itself be reduced yet further to the order of events, mere flights of fingers and an occasional mouse gesture which register elsewhere on a screen as a two-dimensional text or a three-dimensional video, the song their fingers play on these keyboards ringing forth in a well-orchestrated, albeit cacophonous and often discordant, symphony. It is sung in the most base and lewd verse, atonal and unmetered, yet enthralling to many, the mythical epic of Anonymous. Anonymous was not always this complex. It was only in late 2010 that the activist group became such a tangled and constantly shifting labyrinth. In November 2010, the Minotaur running the maze of Anonymous had not yet found its escape route into the world, but it was getting closer. Chanology was still ongoing, and Anon-Ops IRC remained the central nerve center for a cavalcade of DDoS campaigns lobbed against the copyright industry. By the end of November, this steady stream of direct action in support of file sharing came to a screeching halt. Participation in the public-facing IRC channels dwindled to an all-time low. But the core teams, who had collaborated on the private channels, did not quietly shutter the doors and close up shop, though the low numbers did worry them. Instead, they sought to organize themselves better. A brainstorming session resulted in a collaboratively written document hashing out the purpose and structure of the private channel pound command, which scandalized the broader ranks of Anonymous, publicized earlier in November. The document, which existed in various garish states, first defined the limited role of pound command as acting as an intermediary that does not take decisions alone and should lead only the discussion, not the direction of the operations. The document ends with a list of rules, including the ironic pronouncement that only grown-ups are allowed to be in command. Ironic because a number of the individuals were under 18. And really, Anonymous as grown-up? There are many concepts embedded in this document that are likely unfamiliar to IRC virgins and could bear some explanation. First, you use an IRC client to connect to a server, and then you pick a handle or nick. This could be your legal name, but more typically it's something else. You have the option to speak one-on-one with other connected users, or you can join channels, which are denoted by a preceding octothorpe, pound, and can be joined by any user who knows of the room's existence, assuming it's not an invite-only room. Once you join a room, you converse with other users who are there, typically about a channel-specific topic. Whoever creates the channel is called the channel founder and has a certain amount of power to change its properties, determining who can enter, whether the channel is visible in the server's list of public channels, and so forth. These operators can also bestow, at least in some versions of IRC, power on others, adding them to what's called the auto-op, AOP list. Anyone on that list can kick anyone else out of the channel for whatever reason they choose, and even ban them from returning. At a higher order of power are the IRC ops, a faction who run the server and have the power to not only kick people from individual channels, but also from the server itself, disconnecting them completely. IRC ops also have the ability to alter individual channel configurations and perform many other administrative functions. Typically, there are many individual channel operators, but few IRC server operators. For many IRC ops, getting involved in any individual channel's dispute is a frustrating exercise, requiring them to pass judgment on events they were not privy to. As a result, channel decisions are typically deferred to the channel operators, with a server admin intervening only in extreme circumstances. Rules in command. Nobody kicks and certainly not bans inside command. Don't interrupt another one's subject. First point out the matters at hand, then point out priorities. People who troll in command get permanently thrown out of the AOP list. Personal disputes are taboo. Grown-ups only. No off-topic subjects in staff discussions. Pointing out problems in a structured way. Name problem, suggest solution. If you can't hint a solution, then at least give evidence or argue your statements, as long as your point is valid. If you don't like somebody, get over it. We are all in this together.